All across America and around the world, this is Veterans Radio.
This is Veterans Radio.
And now, your host for today's program, Dale Thronberry.
Good afternoon and welcome to Veterans Radio. My name is Dale Thronberry, CW2 type helicopter pilot in Vietnam, 1969. We're going to welcome all of you to Veterans Radio today. We've got a great program. We're going to be looking at Tet, the Tet Offensive of 1968, 50 years ago. It started actually on the 31st of January, I believe it was. And actually, we've got some people here that were involved in it before it even happened. We've got a couple of members that were up in Khe Sanh. I've got another gentleman who was in Hue. And I encourage you to give us a call today on the program. If you were involved in Tet in 1968, please feel free to give us a call at Veterans Radio. Our number is 734-822-1600. That's 734-822-1600. And for those of you that want to call us toll-free, you can give us a try at 844-838-1600. And you can follow us on Facebook, follow us on Twitter. We've got all kinds of social media out there. Check us out at veteransradio.net. I think you're going to find we've got almost 15 years worth of programs out there now. And so we're pretty excited. Speaking of excited, I don't know if you pay attention to our theme when it comes on. It's called Spirit of Corps. And we've used this music as almost 15 years now, but I'd like to give a little shout out here to a local high school, Pioneer High School in Ann Arbor, Michigan. Played that at their concert this week, and it was awesome. I don't think they played it because of us, but it was awesome to hear it played by an orchestra or a full symphony band. Played that. So I'm going to have to go over there and ask if we can get permission to use their copy. Right now we're using the Marine Corps band's copy, and they give us permission to do that. So I wanted to give a shout-out to Pioneer High School here in Ann Arbor. It was really great. The other thing, I just got an email from a good friend of ours, Ron Camarda, who is actually his father, Ron Camarda, down in Florida, and to point out that yesterday was the 75th anniversary of the four chaplains that went down on the USS Dorchester during World War II. It is now called Four Chaplains Day. So, and he says blessings to all who remember these four chaplains that went down 75 years ago. Well, things are going fast. I'm getting too old. So I remember all these things happened during my lifetime, it seems like. So we're going to be talking, as I mentioned, about Tet and about Khe Sanh and about all kinds of things about Vietnam. All the bump music that we're using today was produced by veterans, and it's on a CD that we played about a year ago now. It's called Folk Music from Vietnam, and if I got that wrong, I hope that somebody corrects me, but I'll look it up during one of our breaks to make sure I give you the correct title of where all of this music came from. But joining me in the studio right now is a good friend of ours here at Veterans Radio, and that is Larry St. Antoine. And Larry, welcome back to Veterans Radio.
It's great to be here.
I have to, again, apologize to Larry, as I did before. Those of you that may have looked at the flyers, I misspelled CBs again. I claim that it's delirium caused by the flu. When I was working on the flyer the other evening on my deathbed, I thought, and so I immediately got an email from Larry. I also got three more emails by CBs who I didn't even know listened to the program that called me all kinds of names. I'm sure that Larry might be more familiar with the terminology they were using, but you mentioned that some people have a tendency to misspell that. It's S-E-A-B-E-E-S. Am I right?
Correct. Yeah.
You know, I got to get more than one word answered out of you today.
Okay.
So we've got Larry in the studio, and we're going to take a quick break. And when we come back, we've got retired Marine because they never retire. I know that. But we have a Colonel Dick Camp, and then we've also got an Army helicopter pilot, Bob Ford, who happened to be in Hue during the Tet Offensive. So we've got a lot of things that we're going to be able to talk about. And again, I encourage you to call in with your questions or your comments or your own stories. This is why we do these programs, is for you, the veterans, and for the veterans' families out there. So maybe you can get a little understanding of what many of these men and women went through. We've all You know, most of us are familiar with the Tet Offensive. Anybody who was in Vietnam, of course, is. But a lot of people are not. And hopefully we can maybe clear up some of the issues about it and maybe tell some people about things that they didn't really understand and they really didn't know, because I've learned a lot in the last week's cramming to learn about this today. So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, it's Tet, folks, 1968. We'll be right back. You're listening to Veterans Radio. Back on Veterans Radio, that music was called Symphony for the Sons of Nam, that part of the album I was talking about. As I mentioned in the studio, we've got Larry St. Antoine. He was a Navy Seabee. He was in Quezon just prior to the Tet Offensive, and he's going to kind of fill us in a little bit on what was going on up in that beautiful part of Vietnam. Joining me on the line right now, we've got two guests. Number one I'm going to bring on is Dick Camp, and Dick is a colonel in the United States Marine Corps. And was got to enjoy the confines, real confines, of Quezon during 1968. Dick, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thanks a lot. Glad to be here.
It's glad to have you back on. I met Dick Wednesday night. There was he was in Ann Arbor at giving a talk about Quezon, and so I was lucky enough to grab him and arm twist him so he would come on the program. I appreciate it very much.
My pleasure.
Also joining me on the line from Texas is Bob Ford. Bob was a captain in the Army and a helicopter pilot, and he was in Wei. And he's got a book of his own out there called Black Cat 2-1. Welcome back to Veterans Radio, Bob.
It's my pleasure. Thanks very much. I was a lieutenant, actually, and from Oklahoma.
Well, okay, you were, yeah.
But I like the Texans, believe me.
No, you don't. I remembered. When I went to flight school at Fort Walters and ran into guys from Texas and from Oklahoma, they were not friendly.
I thought the world of Texans, to tell you the truth. I really did. I can't wait to hear from Larry, the CB. God, I had such great regard for these CBs. I really did. And I can't wait to hear what he wants to say. I'd like to just be a listener here, but I'll contribute where I can.
Okay, that's the goal of the game here. Is that each of you, all three of you, get a chance to tell your stories or jump into the conversation anytime you want. For our listeners out there, if you're just tuning in now, we're going to be talking about Quezon and the Tet Offensive. And if you'd like to get in on the conversation, please feel free to give us a call at 734-822-1600. All right, I'm going to start off with Larry first of all, because you actually ended up. You were in Quezon way prior to the Tet Offensive.
I was one of the three-man fire team that went up there to work on their water treatment system in May and June of 67. Unfortunately, that was what they called during the hill fights, and I really believe that was when they started really building up and getting ready for Tet. There was a lot of NVA movement up in the mountains there. And we got rocketed almost every night. The three of us were there for almost 2 weeks, and then we had to get medevaced one evening when our tent got hit by one of the rockets.
Hold on. That's you bypass these things like, oh, that's an everyday occurrence.
Yeah.
What does a CB do, first of all?
Well, basically, we're a construction battalion with the Navy.
Okay.
Mostly we build Marine bases, Marine camps. We built Quezon. Our job in Quezon at that time was to build the infrastructure in there to keep the runway going. And at that time, we were building an underground hospital. The Seabees figured that it's such a long flight from Quezon to some of the medevac areas that it would be easier to have a hospital with doctors and right there where they could operate. And luckily, we had most of it done the night we got hit. We lost two CBs, and we had 27 CBs injured. And on one of the hills, there was eight Marines that were killed.
So this was in
67.
June, July?
It was end of May. July 6th is when we got hit.
Okay. And I've heard this story before, but I want our audience to hear this because you mentioned that your tent was hit.
Yes.
Where?
A direct hit. Well, we were lucky. It hit the top of the tent post. The rocket went off in the air instead of inside the tent. So that probably kept everybody in the tent from being killed. But there were two fatalities. Mm-hmm. We were the only fatalities that night on the base, other than the eight Marines on the hill that were killed. And they figured it was a feint. Mm-hmm. Keep us busy while they overran the hill. I don't know what hill it was, though.
So. Okay. I'm going to bring Dick Camp in on this because when did you arrive at Quezon?
I got up there in July of 1967, after the hill fights.
Okay, so you were there both were there at the same time, back and forth.
Almost. I left before he got there.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Dick, once you arrived at Quezon, we've all heard about this siege of Quezon, but nobody really understands the whole thing, I don't think. What was the advantage of Quezon in as far as our presence, being there? Why were we there?
Well, that's a darn good question. There are two sides of that. One is that Westmoreland wanted us to be out there to suck the North Vietnamese in so that we could hit them with airstrikes and artillery. The North Vietnamese say that they sucked a reinforced regiment out in the hinterlands so they could hit the city. So somewhere in between is the real story.
Could you tell me where Quezon was in relationship to Vietnam and its surrounding areas?
Sure. It's in the northwestern sector of Vietnam, just below the demilitarized zone, probably, 8 or 9 miles, Bob?
Yeah, pretty much. It was the northwestern-most outpost.
Okay, and I know it was just right near Laos as well.
You could see Laos, pretty much.
It was.
Probably about 8 miles from
there. The only thing closer to Laos was Lang Bay, and you know what happened out there.
Literally, you could look from Laos into Lang Bay. It was only a couple of miles. Less than that.
Right. All right. So you, Larry, this is for you. You felt that they were kind of being prepped there as a pre-invasion feint.
Yeah. The feint was that night hitting the main base and wiping out the hills. But they were building up all around Quezon, the North Vietnamese. They were bringing in troops and, I think everybody on the base knew that something was going on that wasn't normal, like in 66 or 65, at the beginning. So things were happening, but no one said anything about it.
Okay.
Yeah, at our level, nobody knew what was going on because no one told us that the North Vietnamese were coming in or that Westmoreland had made a decision to send the regiment out there. In fact, the regiment was brought in piecemeal. It was one battalion, two battalions when I got there in, July, and then they brought in another one after December, maybe first part of January, and then they brought in another battalion later on.
That was Dick Camp. He's got a book out as well, and I like to promote these books because his book right now is Lima 6, which is not a brand new one, but it's a story of a Marine, a young Marine, commander arriving in Vietnam, his adventures there, which are many, that's for sure. So, Dick, when you got to Quezon, what was your perception of the whole area?
Well, it was a good area because it was cool up there. It was on a plateau surrounded by jungle, and it was a heck of a lot better than being out in along the coast because that was so hot and humid. But Quezon was kind of a nice place to be. It was the old hunting grounds for the kings of Vietnam.
Oh, I never knew that.
Yep. I didn't either.
Bob Ford, I've got a question for you. When did you arrive in Vietnam?
July 67, and made aircraft commander in 6 weeks and took over the detachment. And we're stationed at Wei. And what these gentlemen are saying is very true. They increased their strength in piecemeal. And between time I took over the detachment, which was 13 September of 67, until 21 January of 68, that you could just feel it more and more. Because we went out there a lot to resupply Lang Vae, as well as a small outpost just south of Khe Sanh called Hung Wah. And it was it was occupied by the 1st Division of the Arvin Division, the South Vietnamese, which was a crack division, by the way, with American advisors. Mm-hmm. And so you just knew it. Something was coming, especially once Christmas, around Christmas time. And mm-hmm. then 21 January, when they declared Khe Sanh under siege, was when we had a combat assault that I could tell you about that proved out to be the very beginning of the siege of Khe Sanh.
Okay, and Dick, you mentioned in your talk the other night that the 21 January is when really Tet really began, as far as you were concerned.
Sure did. They started shelling us with rockets and artillery mostly from Koh Rock Mountain in Laos.
Wow. Can you describe? I don't know. I'll start with you, Dick. But can you describe the sensation of these rockets coming in? Because I don't think people can understand that the fear. Of you hear a boom, and then if you hear the boom first and the shush, that's not good. It's when I forget which it is anyway. Either one, they scared me.
The first indication you had that you were going to be under incoming was a pop out in the distance, and then you heard this zhoo, just like that, and then the explosion. And I will tell you that having been under that several times, you're absolutely terrifying. It's absolutely terrifying because you think that every one of those rascals is going to hit you right in the back.
And speaking of that, can you tell our audience a little bit about the type of equipment that the North Vietnamese regular army had? This is a regular army. This wasn't BC, right?
Yeah, it was. They had everything that we had except aviation. They had 122 millimeter rockets. 122 millimeter artillery pieces and 152s, and they had mortars. So they had everything that we would have.
Wow, I don't think many of us. I'm trying to play devil's advocate here. I can't quite play civilian, but I can. I can say. We just imagine that they had these rockets that they lashed between two poles. And threw them out there. And I know that in reality, down in Three Corps, sometimes they did have rockets that they just lashed two sticks together and leaned them against, and they'd still hit their targets. But the idea is that they also had tanks?
Yes.
Yeah, they had tanks that overran Lang Vae Special Forces Camp after the siege started, and they were amphibious tanks. They brought through the jungle, believe it or not, up the river and used them to overrun the base.
Wow. And Bob, you were involved in that Lang Vae?
Well, we resupplied. I was not involved when they attacked. I was not. But he talked about the 21 January, we had a mission just to resupply those guys, and they said that they were under siege. Well, you thought, well, maybe so, maybe not, but there's no way I'm not going to go.
Right.
And I had another guy go ahead of me, and his crew chief got shot, and he aborted the mission. And I went in, and I could not believe it. I was over a click away from Hung Wah and started seeing just enormous amount of rifle fire, the muscle mm-hmm. flashes. I thought, my God, what are these guys upset mm-hmm. about? Because I was the only guy in the sky. I said, I can't believe they're trying to just shoot me down. Well, I made it in, and they said, and I got out, and they said, we don't know if we can ever come out and get this thing, get your mm-hmm. Get your supplies. I said, boy, I had my hands full. I said, well, I'll be back in 3-0. Mm-hmm. And when I came back, it was even worse. And then unbeknownst to me, they radioed and said they're going to have an emergency combat assault and land within a click of an old French fort and relieve Hung Wah. Well, I thought, gosh, this will never work. I said, you guys, there's no way in the world this will work. I've never seen so much gunfire. Well, the colonel did not take my recommendation of getting either artillery, they said they couldn't get it, or some two flights of F-4s or something. And then we went out with five ships, and we got completely overrun. Every Vietnamese we put in the landing zone was killed. We had we lost some wonderful men that I knew, and that's when they declared the caisson under siege. And I said, no kidding. It was, and like you said, they never let up after that, after the 21 January.
Wow.
Yeah, Bob, I've read about the action that you had, and it was just unbelievable. They got the advisor and really shot to pieces that whole South Vietnamese outfit.
Well, it was. It was what we call the RFPF, the RFPF guys. And you're right. I wasn't going to bring that up, but the colonel that designed that operation wanted to be in the lead aircraft and lead the John Wayne-type charge into Hung Wa and relieve him, and that was the ship that got shot down, and he was killed on the spot.
Yeah, it was ridiculous. They should never have gone in there.
Right.
Never.
Hey, Bob, who did you belong to anyway?
I was a 282nd Assault, Black Cats.
Okay, all right, I got it now.
Yeah, okay. I tried to get it stopped. I was a first lieutenant, although I hadn't, my judgment had never been questioned up till then, never. And this guy pointed his finger right at me and said, "You're getting out of the line, Lieutenant. Do you understand that?" And God, I couldn't stop it. I couldn't stop the combat assault with these guys.
He paid, and unfortunately, he took a lot of people with him.
I think many of us probably had missions like that where nobody took our advice. Not that we knew what we were talking about, but our gut told us not to do a particular mission or do it a different way, and they decided they'd just go on and do that the same way. I had a colonel that told me something similar to that, and he ended up getting killed too. For our audience, give us a call. If you don't believe this stuff, this is your opportunity to ask these questions. These are three veterans that were there, and they knew what was going on, and it was frightening. And I want to make sure that people in our audience understand that being in war, and being especially in a war like that, is frightening. And you do your job, though. And that's the difference, I think, is that, you know, you do your job. Now, Dick, you mentioned the other night about the perimeter and the defenses, I guess you could say, at Khe Sanh were not, I wouldn't say they weren't not, they weren't up to snuff. You ended up having to dig a lot deeper trenches and so forth.
Yeah, we didn't, there was really no concrete bunkers up there or substantial bunkers. It was just really trenches that that we dug ourselves. Hey, by the way, I want to give a shout out to the CB. The water facility that you put in supplied us for the whole siege. If the North Vietnamese had never knocked that out, boy, we'd have had a tough time. But thanks a lot.
Oh, you're very welcome. It was, you know, I can't say it was a pleasure putting it in, but it was a job, like Dale says. You know, we learned that you don't volunteer too often to go up to places like that, but it was worthwhile to set up the things for those guys because they lived. You're right. It wasn't set up for any kind of attack. The night we got hit, we were ready. We had to sit down in the bunker with 20 guys that were wounded waiting to get overrun. And so we didn't even know where to go. It was a scary night.
Yeah, and the medical battalion, you know, moved right into that bunker that you built for them, and they made it through the whole siege. Never took a casualty down there.
Well, that was the place we brought in steel I-beams, and I think it was like 15 feet underground. It was really fortunate that we built that before the siege, that it got done before the siege. I'm sure a lot of guys made it through because of that.
Oh yeah, there were hundreds of casualties that they took care of.
Well, we got to use it first though.
Yeah,
it's always nice.
I'm not so sure I'd be proud of that.
We tested it out for you, and
good for you. Thanks a lot.
It seemed to work, right?
Yeah.
Okay, we got about 2 minutes to go before we got to take a break. Let me go back to Bob for a second. You were down in Wei, and what happened in Wei, real quickly, and we'll come back to it after the break, but what happened the night of the 31st with you?
Well, it was about 3 a.m. I remember it very well because the forward air controllers were flying all night. They're called the cat killers, and they're flying the Army FACs, forward air controllers. And you don't sleep real well, and they were coming in and going back out. And at 3 a.m., one came in, and the other guy got up, and he said, "Hey, anything you want to look at? Anything you want to tell me?" He said, "Yeah, I'll be watching for about 5,000 NVA coming in from the northwest." You know, and I thought he was kind of kidding. And all of a sudden, crack, the first rocket hit in the compound. And when you described hitting the compound, the rocket, I've been trying to describe it. The best way I can describe it is somebody snapping a big dang limb inside your head. Whoa. Because it just scrambles your brains, and the concussion just makes you feel like you're floating up in the air and you're out of your body. And that's when everything got started right then at that time.
Hey, Bob, you had Black Cats had a great reputation throughout the I Corps, by the way.
Well, thank you, because we were always just doing what was expected of us, to tell you the truth. But you're right. I think we did also.
That's what we all did when we were over there. People don't
that's
understand
exactly
it.
Right.
So we're going to take a quick break, and when we come back, we're going to figure out what's going on next. So you're listening to Veterans Radio, folks. We'll be right back. Probably one of the theme songs of being in Vietnam is you want to go home. I think it's the theme of any warriors anywhere. All they want to do is go home. Welcome back to Veterans Radio. We are talking about Tet Offensive of 1968. It's the 50th anniversary. I can't understand that because I'm only 12. But wow, it seems like it really does seem like it. Well, thank you. but joining me on the program right now in studio, we've got Larry San Antoine, who is a Navy CB MCB4, in the studio. On the line, I've got Colonel Dick Camp, United States Marine Corps. He's the author of a book entitled, well, the one I've got up here right now is Lima 6, a Marine Company Commander in Vietnam. It's a very good read. And then I've got my good friend Bob Ford on, and his book is entitled Black Cat 2-1. And it's another one, the true story of a Vietnam helicopter pilot and his crew. And there's many of us that would love to sit down and write a story about our crews because they're the ones that kept us alive. I encourage you out there as an audience, if you'd like to get in on the conversation, give us a call here at Veterans Radio. The number is 734-822-1600, or you can call us toll-free at 844-838-1600. So let's get back to Bob. I want to get back to you again. You were just starting to talk about when the Tet Offensive hit Way City in January 31st of 1968. So 3 o'clock in the morning. Seems like it started at 3 o'clock in the morning pretty much all across the country. This was a very organized attack, wouldn't you say?
Well, there's no question about it. Now, the day before, one of the cat killers came in that night for our briefing with our senior advisor, Colonel Peter Kelly, and he said, "You won't believe what I've seen. I've seen VC flags flying in every house along all the way from on Highway 1 from Way all the way up to Quang Tri and a place called Dong Ha." And he said, "I've never seen something like this. Something is really up." And so I sent my door gunners back out to the airfield, which is in the middle of the Citadel, and they got the machine guns out of the, we kept them in a big Connex container and brought them back to the compound and set them up on the perimeter. And if it hadn't been for them, they would have broken through on one of the places for sure. But, yeah, it was a very chaotic situation like any ground attack would be. And they came in with RPGs and, of course, small arms. And it was just nonstop for at least 4 hours, it seems. Hey, but before I go further, though, I got to tell you, the CVs we all agree that they do anything and do it fast. And as Army helicopter pilots, every Marine, we always said from PF nothings all the way up to three-star, we called every Marine high diddle diddle up the middle because we never saw one that didn't want to fight. We had such great regard for you guys all the way through. But Ted, our bunker was hit really hard, and I lost every one of my pilots to either wounded or killed on that first night, the first attack. And so when I finally got out of there after 3 days and nights, I call that my 72-hour day in my book because, honest to God, I don't ever remember sleeping. Mm-hmm. And it was a constant deal. And I don't know why they didn't overrun us. They just like Quezon, they must have had some long-term plan because there are 5,000 of those guys, the highly trained NVA, within our compound. And the only thing they had at the time, way before the Cavs started putting pressure on them, they only had the 1st Arvin Division, and they had them completely confined in the Citadel, and they couldn't do very much. And so it was, we always thought we were going to be overrun any night. We really did, and even had made plans to escape and evade.
Well,
there was only 200 of us.
Wow. And Dick, I know up
Quezon.
Yes, thanks. Up at Quezon, I know that you were thinking the same thing, that ground attack was any second.
Well, we had a joke. We had a sign in our combat operations center, and the sign says, "Tonight's the night." And so every night we would turn that up so we could see it. Tonight's the night. Just kind of kidding that North Vietnamese would show up. But they were trying to dig their way to the perimeter, and they started in Laos with trenches and kept digging them closer and closer, despite the fact that we were hitting them with massive amounts of air power and artillery. Rascals were pretty disciplined.
Oh, boy.
Yes. I've got a caller on the line. I'd like to bring him on right now if I can. I've got Jay. Jay, welcome to Veterans Radio.
Oh, thank you, Dale.
Where were you and when?
I was stationed at Dong Ha, and I got there about 4 days before Ted.
Welcome to Vietnam.
Yeah, and I was operations officer forward for the 3rd Engineer Battalion. So we also had a company at Quezon, so I flew into Quezon a few times. And it was an interesting period. I heard the comments on the perimeter on Quezon, which was really true. The first time I contacted the company at Quezon to see if there was anything they needed, and the water supply for Quezon was outside the perimeter. And so they felt they could use some bulk fuel hose as backup for the pumping station. And probably the first day at Ted at Dong Ha, I went over to the bulk fuel company, and there was nobody around because we were getting incoming all the time also. And I picked up a lot of bulk fuel hose. And then the next day I was able to get a flight into Quezon, which was kind of interesting. You went down to the helicopter spot, and you waited for a helicopter, and it happened the commanding general of the division was flying in at the same time. And the belly of the helicopter was filled with anti-tank mines because they felt he had some tanks in the area. And we put the bulk fuel hose on top of the anti-tank mines and flew up Route 9, and then we started taking small arms fire. And it was funny, everybody hit the deck, and then we all started laughing because by hitting the deck, we were increasing our chances of being shot, you know. But, and then in Quezon itself, as you probably heard, the shelling there was almost continuous. At Dong Ha, we had shelling quite a bit, but not as much as Quezon. And it's one of the strange things, I think, or how interesting in the whole crazy war, it happened that the operations officer for the regiment was somebody I had known in California before. And so I got to talk to him a little bit. But he was scheduled to go on an R&R the next day. And even though the siege was going on, he left for R&R. because he was meeting his wife in Hawaii.
Well, we could certainly understand that. Thanks for listening, and thanks for giving us a call, Jay. We appreciate it very much. And God bless you for surviving and being home. So welcome home to you.
Okay. Thank you. Bye.
All right. So he's describing going in and out of Larry St. Antoine, who's in the studio with me today. He's talking about the water supply, and that for whatever reason, that the North Vietnamese never...
Whoever was in charge of the North Vietnamese that surrounded Khe Sanh, either they didn't know what they were doing, it's just astounding that they didn't cut off the water supply because it was outside the perimeter, and so they would have had to fly the water in, along with the ammunition and everything else they were flying in.
Dick, I want to bring you back on because you talked the other night about the siege and the lack of sanitation, let's put it that way.
Yeah.
That was going on for 77 days.
Well, I don't think that if they had destroyed our water point, I'm not so sure that we could have resupplied. We had 6,000 Marines and a few Army and some Air Force up there. I'm not so sure that we could have held out. We would have had to try and evacuate, I think.
Wow. I mean, this is all just...
There's no history.
it's frightening. I mean, it's really frightening when people, I hope people are realizing that this, all these things are true. We're not going to be talking about anything about political things, about what was going on at home. We're talking about survival here. Mm-hmm. And the way that you three men, were able to come through and how many friends that you lost along the way because of this offensive. And, I have to try and maintain my own.
Well, the people who might not know that the idea of the Tet Offensive was for the North Vietnamese originally, I think, was to surround Khe Sanh and then meet up with the Viet Cong in the south. Mm-hmm. And instead, I think it was around 30,000 troops surrounded Khe Sanh and never went south. If they would have just left Khe Sanh surrounded, mm-hmm. and hit south and met up with the North Vietnamese, the Viet Cong, it might have been different.
Well, the overall strategy for the North Vietnamese on the Tet Offensive of 1968 was to go into the cities, and I think there were something like 38 cities that they attacked. And the idea that they had was that the South Vietnamese would rise up mm-hmm. and support them mm-hmm. yep. to overthrow the government. And, of course, it didn't happen.
Didn't happen, no.
No, I mean, from a military standpoint, this was really, decimating to their troop strengths and so on.
Yeah. Well, I know if you go up to Khe Sanh right now, there's a marble or a rock that says that they overran Khe Sanh. They killed over 1,000 Marines, and they shot down over 300 airplanes. And, none of that's true. It didn't happen. Khe Sanh lasted.
Bob, I'm going to ask you what was going on in Hue while Khe Sanh was going through their toils and troubles.
Well, one thing that worked in the NVA's favor down at Hue and all across Northern I Corps was the weather. It was probably the longest sustained monsoon that you could find, and it worked in their favor in maintaining their hold at Hue, and they probably thought they were going to be able to keep it. I got out. I was medevaced by a Black Cat. Two of them came up and with escort and got me out, and I only had three door gunners and one crew chief also. I slept a day, and then I was the only one that, after that, the weather socked in. I was the only one that knew how to get into there low level, and so I led a flight of five in there for resupply through the Marines. And then I stayed. The other guys went back, and I took medevacs to Phu Bai and did that for one day. And then the next day after that, I took another aircraft commander with me because I knew a Peter pilot was co-pilot, mm-hmm. would never be able to get me out of there or know what to do. And I took another aircraft commander, and during until the 6th of February until the 18th, we flew 62 missions into the Citadel, and picked up Marines and after resupplying them and took them to Phu Bai, then supplies back from Fubai up into the Citadel. And they, for just for us, they set up a refueling point that we call Omaha Beach. I know you did it. Set up a place to refuel out there on the coast. So I wouldn't, because it was just amazing what you did in such a quick period of time. So it was, the weather was such that you never could get over 300 feet off the ground. And so we stayed right on the deck, and the visibility was no more than a quarter of a mile. And it worked in their favor, but we went in and out the entire time, and the Marines were just, of course, magnificent, as usual. You never would have known that they were even under siege when you picked these poor wounded guys up. They would just look like, don't take me away from the fight.
Right, just leave me here. I want to keep fighting. And it just seemed like everybody, you know, wanted to do that. Dick, what was going on up there at Quezon again as it was getting worse and worse? You mentioned that a little humorous aside, is that you were accused of stealing things?
Yeah. Of course, you're trying to build up your defenses all the time. And so if there was barbed wire, just sitting there, you'd steal that to beef up your defenses. We sandbags. And eventually we put in mines, but everything was up for grabs to try and defend your portion of the perimeter. Bob mentioned the resupply. And Quezon was built around a runway where they could bring in transport aircraft. Well, after the siege started, of course, they zeroed in on the runway, and the transport aircraft couldn't come in. So then they tried what they call a fly real low off the runway and then throw out a parachute, and it would drag these pallets of supplies off, but then that ruined the runway, so they couldn't do that anymore. And finally they had to parachute everything in for us.
Yeah, but you mentioned, though, that it seemed like the North Vietnamese knew when all these resupplies were going to arrive, and they just wait for everybody.
Well, they had great observation because there were hills all the way around us, and in fact there was a 10-15 ridgeline that was in meters. And if they had spotters up there, they could certainly see everything that was going on.
Holy mackerel. All right. So you went, did you have enough food and supplies ever, or did you get into rationing it at all?
Well, most of my experience in Vietnam, you only had two meals a day, and they were sea rations, little green cans.
Yes.
You lost a lot of weight, I will tell you that.
Yes, but they could be used as weapons, too.
Sure. Throw them at them.
Yeah, if all else fails. Bob, down in Hue, as you mentioned, you know, how long was Hue under siege?
Well, until the 18th, for sure. They sure were. And
this was the 18th of February?
Yep. Yeah, that's when I quit flying. Okay. Into there, I went on R&R on the morning of the 20th, and the 18th, I got my stuff together. I had to go to the Da Nang morgue and ID one of my men, and then went on R&R. But it was pretty well under control by the 18th of February.
Mm-hmm.
And I can't remember exactly when Quezon was declared not under siege, but I know it lasted 70 days, am I saying that correctly?
I think it was close to 80.
80, okay.
Close there.
All right.
So, Dick, were you there for the whole thing, or did they get you out as well?
I left about, I think, a week before the official end of the siege. I went down to be the commanding general of 3rd Marine Division. I became his aide.
All right, so let's look at the military strategy behind this Tet Offensive, and we've touched on it already. The idea was that the North Vietnamese were going to come in through the north and hit all of these cities, and, you know, the South Vietnamese were going to rise up. Well, they didn't rise up. And so we went on for another 7 years after that. What is your opinion of our strategy, let's put it that way, at that time? Start with Dick.
Well, that's a good question. I'm not so sure that I can answer it.
Just our opinions. That's all it is. Just between the four of us.
Well, I think they thought, Westmoreland and crew thought that if we killed enough of them, that would, you know, attrition would take care of the fight. And mm-hmm. it just wasn't, because the North Vietnamese were highly disciplined, and they, it was a nationalistic movement, and so they, you know, just hung in there until we decided that we'd had enough and come home. I will tell you this, the Tet Offensive of 68, in my view, is that when the North Vietnamese sappers were killed trying to get into the embassy, and they actually killed some military police there, mm-hmm. Overall, militarily, our armed forces basically wiped out the infrastructure of the Viet Cong and killed literally thousands of them. So militarily, we won, but politically, because our country saw those sappers in there, and you know, we had been repeating time and time again that it was light at the end of the tunnel, and then you had this terrific fight. Politically, we lost at that stage.
Yeah, I agree, Bob.
Well, he nailed it pretty good. Anytime I have ever talked to a group, I make the statement: I know we lost 58,000. Mm-hmm. How many enemy combatants do you think we killed? And this is mm-hmm. all kinds of groups of people, all mm-hmm. kinds, all ages, and nobody has ever guessed more than 150,000 enemy combatants.
I think it has to be much more than that, doesn't it?
2 million. We wiped out an entire generation. We had them completely on their heels, and that was the time after the Tet of 68 to say, okay, guys, do you want any more of this? We can stop it right here, or you're not going to believe what's going to happen next. And and we'll do it, and we'll have a peace agreement, and we will do this leave you guys with have honor, and we'll stop this thing. And what do you think? Let's do it. Mm-hmm. But no, politically, we just didn't do it, and didn't do it right at all.
Larry?
I agree with him wholeheartedly. There were even rumors of the North Vietnamese going to the peace tables after Tet. And because of what was going on back at the States with the newspapers and everything else saying that we lost Tet, I think our casualties were 1,000, around 1,000. The Viet Cong casualties were over 85% of the Viet Cong were killed. Mm-hmm. And then how many were killed around Khe Sanh? You know, I heard 20,000, 30,000 troops of North Vietnamese regulars. And way, I don't know on there, but mm-hmm. I think when the North Vietnamese heard what was going on in the States, the news saying that we lost so many American soldiers in that Tet, they decided not to go to the peace tables. That's the rumors I heard. So I agree that would have been the time for it to happen,
I agree. I agree with that.
Well, I think the North Vietnamese were looking at what was going on in the United States with terrific demonstrations against the war. And they played mm-hmm. off that.
Oh yeah,
no question
definitely.
About it.
Yeah. I would agree with that. Have any of you been back to Vietnam?
I have not.
No,
none of you.
Yeah, I've been
maybe
back.
Last night.
Oh, hold on.
Who? Maybe last night, but
I know that one. But who was it that said they were there? Went back.
I was there, Dick.
Okay. So what's your observation of Vietnam today?
Oh, I think you know, it's a very vibrant country, and they've got a young population, obviously, because we killed an awful lot of North Vietnamese. But it's a vibrant country and business oriented. In fact, if you go to Vietnam now, they have 5-star hotels in major cities, and cost you an arm and a leg to go there. But there was no long. I was back in '98, mm-hmm. and there was no animosity towards us at all.
That's what I've heard from a lot of other veterans who have gone back, that you know, that they don't, you know, they don't hold a grudge, I guess you could say, because, you know, their economy was going on. I was thinking about someone that we talked about the other night. Her name was Young Krall, and she was a South Vietnamese or Vietnamese refugee who came here. And she just thanked every Vietnam veteran she runs into for giving them 10 years of a taste of what freedom was really like. And I think that was a really nice thing. We got about a minute, 2 minutes to go. Okay. Any last comments from you, Dick?
No. While there were, why were we in Vietnam? You know, I've mentioned why, but as far as I'm concerned, I was very proud of what the troops did, and unfortunately, we had a political decision that sent us in there without real goals and objectives, and so we lost 58,000 men.
All right, Bob?
I'm proud every day. I was asked that last night at a Chamber of Commerce. I said, they asked me, do you have any regrets? I said, absolutely none. Mm-hmm. If I lost my life over there and my men, one of my men were standing in front of you right now, they'd say the same thing. Lieutenant Ford did his best, and he's proud of what he did. That's exactly how I feel. I never saw one American out of line, ever. Not mm-hmm. one. Everyone I ever saw served with 100% honor and dedication.
I agree with you. Larry?
I agree with both of them. And I want to take my turn to thank both the Marines and the chopper pilots. We could have never done our job without the Marines protecting us and the chopper pilots bringing us in and out. They're high on my list. And I think that as long as we use our experience to help the veterans we have now that are coming home, I think that's a big thing. Yep.
Good comment.
100% behind you there. Yeah.
All right. Yep. I agree with all of you, and I think it's very true. I'm very proud of my service. I met the finest men and women I've ever met in my life, and as Larry said, I think about them every night. So, till next week, thank you all very much for being on the program.
My honor.
You are dismissed.